Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Great to see everyone and some new faces. We are continuing on with our study of Mishnah Psachim. I'm going to share my screen in just a moment. If you're following along with your own text, we are in the second chapter, Perek Bet, and we're just going to loop back to the Mishnah that we very briefly touched on at the end yesterday, which is Mishnah Bet, the second Mishnah there. And we are recording all of these sessions and hope to make them available for folks who miss some along the way. So I'm going to put this up on the screen here. And you are welcome to chat on the side. I try to take some of those comments along the way as we go. Okay, terrific. So, Chamit Shel Nochri, Sha'avar Alav HaPesach, Mutar Bahana'a. Vishel Yisrael Asur Bahana'a, Shneamar Lo Yera Elecha Seor. We taught this very quickly last time, that chametz is not just the problem on Pesach itself, but also after Pesach is over. Meaning the category of chametz she'avar alav Pesach puts restrictions on what we're allowed to eat of chametz that was not destroyed during Pesach and existed in the world. This Mishnah is basically addressing the question of, is there any way to benefit from chametz after Pesach? Or any chametz that sort of made it through a Pesach is off limits to a Jew afterwards? And the basic distinction that we saw here is between it being owned by a Gentile and it being owned by a Jew. So if it belongs to a Nochri, it belongs to a Gentile over Pesach, then it is permitted afterwards. Nothing wrong with it. Basically, the concern about chametz after Pesach is whether it was owned by a Jew, and therefore, v'shel Yisrael, if in fact owned by a Jew, it is forbidden v'hana'ah, forbidden not just to be eaten after Pesach, but even to have any kind of monetary benefit from it. Shenemar lo yira'eh lecha se'or. I just want to dig a little deeper on this proof text this time. So the Torah doesn't just say lo ye'achel chametz, kol machmetzet lo tochelu, statements that are focused on not eating things that are leavened, but also it shall not be seen, lo yira'eh lecha se'or. That kind of undergirds on some level the prohibition on eating. But it also here is being used for the word lecha, for you. That is to say, it doesn't say lo yera'eh se'or, that there need not be any chametz, there shouldn't be any chametz in the world, you shouldn't see it anywhere. You shouldn't see it as part of something that you own. And therefore, if it's owned by someone who's outside of the covenantal circle of obligation, just nothing happened there and you go back as normal. As I mentioned, this is the basic Mishnah that is the grounding for all subsequent practice of selling chametz, transferring it to non-Jews before Pesach. And the questions of that are obviously very complicated, and they're coming up again in a more serious way this year, where even people who are careful to get rid of all the chametz in their house and not to sell it, that's certainly my practice in my home most years, are considering potential leniencies this year to rely on the very wide practice of selling chametz to the extent they feel there are things they need to store up in a pressing moment at home. Happy to provide guidance offline on anything like that, but I'll just say that indeed it's a longstanding practice when there is some kind of financial or certainly bodily or health concern to rely on the overt selling of chametz to a Gentile, even if you know you're going to buy it back afterwards. That's based on the basic principle laid out in this Mishnah. All right, let's move on to the next one, which is going to now play off of that basic concept, but try to get to what does ownership really mean? You know, sometimes we own things in kind of partial and complicated ways. Do I own my house, right? My apartment. Technically, yes, I have the deed to it, but actually the bank owns a larger percentage of it than I do. And the question of defining who really something belongs to is something we ask generally, but the Mishnah is engaging with it here. Nochri shehilva et Yisrael al chametzo, achara pesach mutar bahana'ah. So if a Gentile lends money to a Jew, literally on his chametz, okay? So what does that mean? It means that a Gentile lends money to a Jew, and a lot of times when you lend someone money, you want some kind of a pledge. You want something that will basically be the collateral to make sure that the person will come back and repay their debt. So if you want to imagine here, for instance, someone not Jewish makes a $100 loan to a Jew before Pesach, and the Jew gives their bottle of scotch to them as a pledge, as a collateral that the Gentile can seize, as it were, if the loan is not paid. The ruling of the Mishnah is that after Pesach, when you get back that bottle of scotch, when you repay the loan, you are allowed to benefit from that scotch. That is to say, the status of the object that has been taken as collateral, even just for the temporary security of a loan, is considered to be sufficiently out of the borrower's property, out of the borrower's domain, that it's not considered to be in their ownership for purposes of Pesach. So essentially, that bottle of scotch on collateral in the Gentile's home is treated as if it belongs to the Gentile, and therefore does not fall under the category of lo yera elecha seor. And the reverse is also the case. Yisrael shehilva et hanochri al chametzo, achar haPesach asur bahana'a. Okay? So here too, in the reverse case, it would be that the collateral that comes from the Gentile to the Jew is considered to belong to the Jew, and therefore after Pesach, it would not be permitted to benefit from that chametz, all right? So that's just the sort of finer point of what ownership looks like when something is transferring domains in one way or another. Chametz shenafla alav mapolet, harehu kemivoar. So now we're switching gears here and thinking about, sorry there, when I highlight, sometimes it jumps around here. Just jumping up. Chametz shenafla alav mapolet harehu kemivoar. If a building collapses on top of chametz, that is considered as if you got rid of it. Meaning, we talked in an earlier Mishnah, do you have to burn it? Or is it enough for it to be dispersed in the air and thrown into the sea? So seemingly following that view where burning is not necessary, but just it being completely inaccessible, it being trapped under a pile of rubble is also considered to be gone. Meaning, you do not need to, before Pesach, go through the rubble, find the chametz underneath it and destroy it. It is fundamentally out of the human realm, and therefore you can just move on with your business getting ready for Pesach and forget about that chametz. So obviously that same basic concept can be extended to, you know, things being thrown into garbage facilities and other things where they're completely sort of taken out of the realm of human access. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel omer, kol she'ein hakelev yachol lechapes acharav. He gives a standard for this. It's not clear if he thinks he is disagreeing with the Tanakama, with the first view here, or just balefaresh. He's coming to explain his standard. But his formulation is, as long as a dog would not be able to find it, to search for it, that's the standard for it being inaccessible. A number of places in the laws of chametz where dogs are very important for establishing the standard. Ra'ui la'achilat kelev is something fit for the consumption of a dog. And the idea there is that even though a dog has a wider range of what it will eat than a human being, it too has its limits. And once you cross that threshold, it's no longer food. Here we have that in terms of basic accessibility. So we have an interesting follow-up question here. For the Jew holding chametz as collateral over Pesach, does it count as benefit if the Jew uses that chametz to get his loan back? I'm not sure I actually totally follow the formulation there. I think the collateral is just sitting there for the purpose of you know, the lender enabling them to pressure the borrower. So it pretty much will sit with the other party until the loan has been dissolved. There's also just a little bit of a general construct here of saying, to the extent it's that much out of your control, it becomes this kind of an object. But maybe I'm not getting the question totally clear. Does the Mishnah in another question here on loans assume that the security is always a pledge, i.e. held by the lender, rather simply collateral in possession of the borrower? Suppose the borrower retains the collateral, i.e. the barrels of scotch. Yes, so the question of whether it is in the person's home as opposed to it is has been moved out, that becomes very important in later discussions of this Mishnah and discussions of the laws in general of selling chametz. If you've ever sold your chametz, you know that today we do this in what seems like a highly formal way, where the original sources on selling chametz really envision handing something over, a real sale, even at a real price. The first phase is sort of to say, yeah, it can be kind of a symbolic price. It can be with a wink, wink of saying, I'll pay you back for it later, but it's still being a real sale. As the leniency on selling chametz expands into more and more you know, operations of scale and even industry, like the main place where it was used was distilleries run by Jews that couldn't empty all of their stocks before Pesach and also couldn't feasibly transfer everything off site. So what you started to do was to have mechanisms whereby you are selling the actual real estate on which the chametz is sitting. And if you look at any of the contracts that people use to sell chametz today, you will see you're asked to enumerate basically all the chametz that you want to sell. And you formally do it by selling the chametz and the shelf space on which they sit, which is a way of saying, actually, there's like a little bit of my house that I transferred to someone else so that I don't have to move it out of my house. So this is an interesting formulation, and indeed that question requires you to go a little bit beyond the limited formulation of the Mishnah. So yeah, the rubble case definitely is part of the general sort of culture of, hey, we got to put some limits on this searching for chametz, and that's what you see here at the end. And yes, you're selling the real estate to someone else, at least the little formal space on which the chametz is sitting. Okay, great. Let's move on now to the next one. And now we're going to get into a different set of issues, bringing us into another area of halakha here. So let's just sort of review and get a brief overview. Sorry, hold on. Screen jumped down. Brief overview of the laws of illegally eating truma. Okay. So truma is, as we've seen in earlier Mishnayot, something that's meant to be set aside for the priest. And a zar, that is to say, someone who is of non-sacred stock, anyone who's not a Kohen, not descended from Aaron, is not allowed to eat truma. Okay, and in fact, truma, we're told in the Torah, if you eat it deliberately, as a non-priest, actually carries what's the penalty that's known as mitah bidei shamayim, which is a kind of heavenly death penalty. That is to say, a very extreme consequence of eating something forbidden, but without any earthly consequences, right? Human courts don't enforce it in any way. That's the penalty if you do it b'mezid. If you do it b'shogeg, kind of without realizing that it was truma, unwittingly, then you are supposed to pay back the value of what you ate to the Kohen, to the priest to whom that truma belonged, or give it to some Kohen if it hasn't yet been given to that person yet. And you're supposed to add on a chomesh, v'chamishito yosef alav. You have to add on a fifth. And in rabbinic tradition, it's generally understood that that fifth is what's called a chomesh milabar, a chomesh that is sort of added on from the outside, meaning it's an amount that when taken in total with the original principle and itself is a fifth. which is a fancy way of saying a fourth, meaning if I have 100 and I add on 25%, then I've got a total of 125% of the original, and the amount I added, the 25%, is a fifth of that. Okay, that's all background for now getting into this Mishnah. Ha'ochel terumat chametz befesach b'shogeg mishalem keren v'chomesh. B'mezid patur mitashlumim umidmei etzim. So here we have a case of you're eating truma, but it's an unusual case of truma in that it's truma that is chametz. So let's say it's like, it could be a loaf of bread that was baked out of dough that was from truma stuff, or any number of other kinds of chametz concoctions that are made out of truma, that are made out of, wheat and other things like that. But you eat it on... So the question is, given what we said earlier, which is that chametz on Pesach is asur bahana'ah, is forbidden to be benefited from, you might say that chametz on Pesach is worthless, right? That is to say, there's actually nothing for you to pay back at all because chametz on Pesach has no worth. The Mishnah comes to actually clarify it and to say, no, if you eat truma, even though it's chametz on Pesach, if you do it without intention, the full amount of the original value, plus that added fifth, that is to say that quarter, that will be a fifth in the final. And that's because the Mishnah's claim is you're not evaluating the worth of the thing by what it is worth now, but by what it was worth for Pesach, sort of its normal market value, not its unusually distorted market value in the bizarre Pesach chametz economy. However, if you eat it b'mezid, if you eat it intentionally, like you know it's truma, you don't care, and you go ahead and eat it, but then you're thereby caught. So here you are actually completely exempt from payment because chametz has no value on Pesach, okay? That is to say, we're playing both sides of this here, and that's the interesting thing about this Mishnah, all right? Which is to say, while normally the rule for eating mezid is that there's a mitah bidei shamayim, there's a sort of divine punishment, you still have to pay back the kohen for what you stole from him. That is to say, in regular time, you normally have to pay back the value of the thing. You just don't have to add the chomesh. You don't have to add a fifth, okay, to it, because the fifth is just bishgaga, says the Torah, only in cases where you do it unintentionally. But so even though you still have to pay back in unintentional cases on Pesach, when you eat intentionally, then what comes to the fore is that we are only focused on the value of the thing. So here's the way in which we're sort of conceiving this as two different kinds of acts. When it is a case of mezid, of intentional violation, it's essentially a kind of an act of theft. Basically, you're saying, I know this is truma, and I'm taking it for myself, okay? But an act of theft really can only be valuated at the value of the object that you are stealing. And the truma that is chametz, that you are stealing, as it were, from the kohen, when it's on Pesach, that is worthless. And so therefore, there's nothing to pay back. Patur mitashlumim, you have no obligation to pay. One, idmei etzim, even for the value it might be as big that, I could burn, I could use it as fuel and I at least have to pay that small amount. No, chametz is worthless on Pesach. And because it's worthless, you owe nothing. But when you eat it unintentionally, that's not really an act of theft against the, an unwitting trespass against God. And because it's an unwitting trespass against God, when you're paying back the value of it, it's a kind of ritual compensation for something that you did wrong. And so then we evaluate it not based on what thing that you just ate, when you're about making compensation to God, the temple, the larger economy. All right, so that's an unusual Mishnah that tries to think about what does it mean when we say chametz may not be fitted from, and is, we're moving on to the next Mishnah here. All right, this is a longer one. This will be the last one that we're going to do. Elu dvarim she'adam yotze vahen yedei chovato ba'pesach. Bechitim, b'seorim, בחוסמין ובשיפון ובשיבולת שואל ויוצאין בדמי ובמעשר ראשון שנטלה תרומתו ובמעשר שני והקדש שנפדו והכהנין בחלה ובתרומה אבל לא בטבל ולא במעשר ראשון שלא נטלה תרומתו ולא במעשר שני והקדש שלא נפדו חלות תודה ורקיקי נזיר עשאן לעצמו Ein yotzin bahen, asa'an limkor bashuk, yotzin bahen. Okay, these are the things that a person can use to fulfill their obligation on Pesach. And it'll be very clear from the list here that we are dealing with different kinds of grain. Chitim and se'orin. Now these are usually treated as wheat and barley, and that's certainly the way we render it today. Most scholars thinking about what these actually meant at the time, think that they mean potentially just a whole bunch of different kinds of wheat. You'll hear about emmer wheat and other kinds of wheat. I'm sure there's other people who are more expert in this on the call than I am. The way we traditionally translate this is what you've got here on Safari, a wheat, barley, spelt, rye, and oats. I think it's felt pretty clearly that there's no way oats is actually what Shibboleth Shu'al means. You're hearing my other child on their learning here in the room. Sorry about that. The oats is unlikely to have been something that was actually eaten in the ancient Near East. But over time, that became the basic standard of what Shibboleth Shu'al means, and certainly was kind of sanctified over time as a legitimate grain to use for matzah. And you'll see oat matzah and spelt matzah. And that's a super interesting question in general of how much does going back and doing botanical archaeology of what was true in the past matter for contemporary halakha? This is something when we get to the next Mishnah tomorrow, we'll see around horseradish and maror. There's no way that horseradish was anything that anyone ever ate for maror before Jews ended up in Europe. And yet that becomes the quintessential maror. In any event, you have five grains here, which seem to be just the standard five grains out of which bread is made in the time of the Mishnah. And we're told that those are all valid. Note, one of the things not on the list is rice. Okay, there was another opinion among the Tanaim, Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, which is that rice was valid to make matzah, and by contrast, rice was a problem of chametz. But the flip side here is that things that are valid for Pesach, for matzah, are also the things that trigger chametz. And now we get a whole bunch of things that are also different ways, different forms in which these grains might be prepared or exist. And the question of whether you can fulfill your obligation for matzah with these kinds of grains. So if the grain, if the matzah you made was made out of demai, which is produce that was only possibly tithe because it was in the possession of someone who's not so careful about that, the eino ne'eman al ha'masrot, the am ha'aretz, yeah, it's only doubtfully not tithed. And therefore, matzah made out of demai, if you ate it, you know, maybe you shouldn't have eaten it, but if you ate it, you fulfilled your obligation. Ma'aser Rishon, if there was a Levi who got the first tithe that was given to him of your produce, and then he in fact took out the Trumat Ma'aser, there was the gift to the Kohen, the 1/100th of the total. The Torah says that you have to give in tatami mena ma'aser mina ma'aser, that you give a tenth of the produce to the Levite, and then the Levite's supposed to give a tenth of that to the priest. So if you, as a non-Levite, ate some ma'aser rishon matzah, matzah made out of that kind of tithing, as long as the part taken for the Kohen was removed, that's also valid. These other characters now, Ma'aser Sheni and Hekdesh, okay? Ma'aser Sheni is the tithe that we take out on the first, second, fourth, and fifth of the sabbatical year cycle to be eaten in Jerusalem. You have to bring it up or redeem it. And Hekdesh is just any object which you took and devoted to the temple, to the sanctuary. And the way you could do that is you could say, I'm devoting this dish that I have here to the sanctuary. And then you don't have to actually bring the dish. You just have to redeem it. So similarly, someone could have a matzah that they baked and say, I'm giving this to the Mikdash, and then say, all right, but I'm not actually giving this matzah. I'm going to change it out for its worth in money. If you had matzah that was from Maaser Sheni or Hekdesh, as long as it was redeemed, no problem to fulfill your obligation with that for matzah. And similarly, Kohanim can use the challah and the truma that they get from other Jews. They can get the part of the dough that's taken off from someone else's matzah, and they can get truma that was given to them and bake it into matzah for themselves. A zar, a non-Kohen, cannot do that, but a Kohen can do that. It's not as if matzah has to be from something that's totally mundane. Those are all the perhaps slightly dicey or special things that are nonetheless okay. However, continues the Mishnah, if the matzah was made of tevel, it was not tithed at all, or it's a matzah of Maaser Rishon, the tithe for the Levi, but the Levi, or you on his behalf, did not take out the Teruma for the Kohen, so it still has a thing that hasn't been properly removed. Or it's Maaser Sheni, something that needs to be eaten in Jerusalem, or something for the temple that was not redeemed. Those are invalid for matzah. So here we have an interesting notion, which is that there might be some aspects of tithing and taking care of things that are desirable, like with demai, you're supposed to do an added tithe because you're unsure if the person you got it from in fact removed the tithes. But if you didn't, the obligation in matzah kind of trumps and wins out. But there are some things which are sort of more overtly treif, they're more overtly forbidden in a way that actually, even though it's a matzah and it's baked exactly right and it went into the oven and came out, all of you did everything within 18 minutes, the fact that it's tevel, the fact that it's just full of sacred produce and tithes that you never removed actually blocks it from being able to fulfill your obligation with matzah. This is an interesting perspective. A lot of people have thought about this in a lot of different contexts of what are the processes that perhaps our food has or hasn't gotten through that kind of make it inappropriate to use it for fulfillment at the Seder. Lots of people thinking about, you know, free trade chocolate and sort of other things in previous years. You know, that's, I think, sort of spiritually tied in a certain way to the basic idea here of using tevil to fulfill the obligation for matzah. You're getting an interference between the mitzvah and some kind of isur, some kind of prohibition. The last line here is also playing on that, which is the question of whether something that's been designated for another sacred purpose can really ever fulfill an average person's obligation in matzah. And it ends with chalot tota urikikei nazir. These are loaves of bread that are brought either with the todah offering, the animal that you bring to celebrate something good that happened to you, or part of the nazir, the Nazirite completion ritual, where you bring a whole bunch of cakes. And these cakes actually are specified not to be chametz, and therefore ingredients and process-wise, they're totally valid as matzah. But the Mishnah says, if you make them for yourself, meaning you're bringing a todah, you're finishing your period of being a Nazirite, and you prepare yourself a matzah for that special ritual, you cannot then use that to eat it at the Seder. It's been designated for another purpose. It has another competing mitzvah function. However, if you made them to sell them in the market, meaning you are actually like a retailer of these things, for people who come along and they're like, oh shoot, I need some chalot for my todah, and you have a little shop that offers chalot todah and rikikei nazir, those you can actually pull a couple off the shelf and use them for your Seder because you didn't really devote them to some specific sacred purpose. You just made them valid and available for that. And until you've sold them, they're actually not really any different from any other matzah. All right. So we're going to leave it there. Is there still relevance for people not living in Israel? So not really on the truma front, though on challah, you know, and separating out dough in that way, it's not going to be relevant for kohanim to eat that because it's not the practice to eat the challah that's separated out in chutz la'aretz, in the diaspora. But as I said, I think there are some sort of larger concepts here that perhaps come out of the Mishnah that are worth thinking about. Great to see you all and learn with you. Looking forward to seeing you again tomorrow. Hope everyone has a great rest of the day.